From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Beyond Einstein's Unified Field with Dr. John Brandenburg. Some real science for you. Here's what's happening. A magnitude 4.3 earthquake hit several hours ago. The center's epicenter was located about 24 miles from downtown Los Angeles. Then a few aftershocks. I didn't feel a thing. Geologist Jim Berkland. Well, that's a pretty good size, isn't it, Jimmy? 4.3?
It's about a one-in-a-month occurrence down there close to you. But, it wouldn't be damaging under almost all conditions. But it was a good little jolt, and that's a good reminder. We're in earthquake country in Southern California, too. And, of course, I just came back from hurricane country.
Sure.
And my grandkids got to feel their earthquake back in Virginia. And I got to feel my first hurricane. Because I was with them just a few days later.
Well, when a 4.3 hits, Jim, does that generally mean the worst is over, or?
Yes, usually.
Good. Well, that's a good sign. Jim Berkland's website, by the way, syzygjob.com. It's linked up on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Hurricane Ketia crept westward in the deep Atlantic, threatening to swell into a major storm by the weekend, just 1 week after Irene caused massive flooding in the U.S. Northeast. Packing winds right now of 75 miles an hour, the Category 1 Ketia threatened to become a major hurricane by the weekend, according to the Miami-based National Hurricane Center. We'll keep our eyes on that for you. Scientists are close to discovering how to do something that humans throughout history have dreamed of accomplishing, summoning rainfall at will. By shooting laser beams into the air, researchers from the University of Geneva realized that in the right conditions, the lasers can trigger the growth of micron-sized water droplets. The experiment, detailed in the Nature Communications Journal, may be a precursor to actually manipulating the presence of significant rainfall. Dr. Nick Begich, well known for his work on HARP, he's with us. This is dramatic stuff, Nick.
Yeah, it is. And actually, it goes back a little bit. I know that article just came out, but a little over a year ago, Russia Today actually published some of the earlier work of the very same scientists that have announced this from the University of Geneva. And what they were doing when they ran into this phenomena was actually trying to direct lightning bolts by being able to shunt them along a ionized column of plasma using ground-based lasers. And what they found is it actually created a stimulation in the chemicals in the atmosphere that actually caused water droplets to start to form and grow. And so actually, Jerome Kasparian, the inventor of this concept, has put together a conference at the the first laser weather control conference in 2011. It's coming up at the end of the month in Geneva, sponsored by the World Meteorological Association or organization in Geneva in cooperation with the university. And they're taking it real seriously. And you know, you can even roll back a little bit further. And there was work done by none other than Bernard Eastland back in 1998. He did it for the European Space Agency using space-based lasers or space-based microwaves to accomplish very similar things for weather modification purposes.
And they're also saying, though, Nick, that you could also use the lasers not only to try to start it to rain, but also to make it stop.
Right, right. And that was actually one of the things that was looked at by the Chinese and the Russians, and they've been talking about this for quite some time. And it's amazing, you know, when you start to think about the idea of manipulating rainfall locally, and the humidity levels were extremely low, 70% humidity, whereas rain normally is 100%.
That's right.
Get that rainfall. So relatively dry air in comparison to what generally generates rain makes it real attractive for parts of the country like Southern California and other places where rainfall can be a real problem.
Nothing like technology, Nick, when it works. If it works. Libya's fugitive ex-leader, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, has said he's ready to fight a very long guerrilla war. In an audio message carried by a loyalist TV channel, Gaddafi if it was him, said that he'll continue to fight. Anti-Qaddafi forces encircling the cities have given loyalists an extra week to negotiate their surrender. Republican presidential hopeful Ron Paul says the feds are preparing for the breakdown of law and order. Where did he say it? None other than on the Alex Jones Show. And here's Alex. Alex, what did he mean by that?
Well, he was just simply stating that the establishment knows that they have set up a political and financial system that will result in depression, that it's a corporate consolidation mode to destroy all independence, and that they do, in the end game, want a collapsed society so then government and multinationals can ride in as the saviors. I had seen a few weeks ago a reporter in Iowa ask him about the National Emergency Centers Establishment Act that just basically legalizes and publicly funds the FEMA camps that major newspapers have already documented exist. And that was brought up to him by a reporter, and he elaborated some, so I just expanded on it, and he clarified and said, yes, that is exactly what he means. So there, it's basically problem, reaction, solution. That's what the globalists, that's what the insiders want, and they do want to use crises that they basically trigger as a pretext to then come in and save the day. I mean, take Libya. I'm no fan of Qaddafi, but they're admittedly putting al-Qaeda in command there now. The leader of the rebels in Tripoli now is an admitted al-Qaeda commander. That's even in the LA Times, Washington Post. And so they use that fake crisis that they spurred as a pretext to go in and take over. And then later we'll have to be back in Libya in 4 or 5 years dealing with al-Qaeda that our own government and the people that control it put into power.
And we gave them a lot of money.
Absolutely.
What's new with InfoWars.com and PrisonPlanet.com, Alex?
Well, George, I'm really just listening to your show as many nights as I can and enjoying all the great work you're doing. I've launched a nightly TV show.
Good for you.
It airs every night at 7 o'clock. I've had a lot of networks and stations, ask me to do a show. So we're basically beta testing it for folks at InfoWarsNews.com. So that's what we're doing new. And we're also just trying to reach out to people and point out that as our society implodes, we need to go back to the Constitution and Bill of Rights, and that is the solution, not more government, more tyranny that the globalists are offering as the solution.
You got it. Alex Jones, thanks. Keep in touch. For the 11th time in the past 4 years, a human foot in a sport shoe has been found on a Pacific Northwest shoreline. Foot number 11 was found near a marina in an inlet called False Creek near Vancouver, British Columbia. I don't know why the police say this, but they say foul play has not yet been suspected because the foot did not show any sign of trauma. Folks, you got a serial killer out that way, and in all seriousness, he's got a foot fetish. Human remains, they say, did not show any evidence of trauma, so they don't know what to do. DNA samples from foot number 11 will be compared to DNA obtained from family members of people who are missing to try to establish some kind of identity. Is Comet Elenin breaking up? A new report states that the comet is dimming and could be falling apart. Some comets are fragile ice rocks that can and do break apart. Up next, Professor James McCanny joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We've got Professor James McCanny now with us as we talk about Comet Elenin and to get James' take on all of this. Hey, James, welcome back, by the way. How are you?
Hi, George. Thank you. Good to be back.
You and I have talked for years about comets either being icy snowballs or, in some cases, heavy pieces of iron, which are very dangerous. What do you think about this comet, James, Comet Elenin?
Well, yeah, George, I've never bought the dirty snowball comet model. You had to talk about comets being electrical discharges of the solar capacitor, but Comet Elenin is just a little teeny comet, and recently it dimmed about 50% as it approached. Right now it's approaching the orbit of Mercury, and so for it to dim at that point simply means it's, and I somewhat concur with this interpretation, first was mentioned in Sky and Telescope magazine, but that is probably breaking up. It's probably breaking up into a lot of little pieces, and it's too far away is too difficult to view it, really. But basically, that's what seems to be going on.
Is that unusual, Jim, for a comet to break apart like that?
No. It's a rare event, but in terms of comets, no, it happens somewhat. We've seen the comet, Schumacher-Levy 9 was one of the very famous ones, broke into 21 pieces. Some of them disintegrate completely. They just break up because of fissures in the rock base or whatever is the structure of the nucleus. The nuclei of comets are one of the more varied things in outer space. They come from chunks of broken up planets or star cores, and so they've had a lot of trauma in their short or their lengthy existence. And so to break up is not the real common, but it's not out of the question. So it's not unusual.
If there's other objects around them with some kind of gravitational pull, would that contribute to the breaking up of the comet?
That can. It's the differential forces. They're called tidal forces, technically in astronomical terms. But yeah, that basically it's one side is being pulled harder than the other side by the gravitational pull of a nearby larger object. And so as it moves into the sun very rapidly and possibly it's spinning, then those kind of things can happen. Or also the interaction with either solar wind or there's a lot of electrical activity as it discharges the solar capacitor. You have an electron beam coming in from the sunward side, which can do a lot of damage and pitting. So there's all kinds of factors that can affect a comet nucleus. To do this, but some are sturdy, some are not, and it appears that Elenin just has probably a lot of fissures in the nucleus, and it's coming apart at this point.
James, if it falls apart, are the little fragments dangerous to planet Earth?
No. It's not like an explosion. They just kind of come apart and move apart very slowly. So the cone, so to speak, of expansion is very slight. By the time this comet goes by Earth, it's coming in front of us, and then we'll kind of cross its path behind the comet. So potentially we might see some meteors. There's always a chance that something could happen, but it'd be an extreme explosion, let's put it that way, within the nucleus, that would cause something to get as far away as Earth from the normal comet orbit.
We're hearing all kinds of stories on the internet. Astronomers are telling us not to worry. Some people on the internet are saying worry about it. Richard Hoagland has his own thoughts on what this thing is. How about you, besides it being a small comet? I mean, is it unusual?
No. No, this is, and I have yet to figure out all of the hype and why that even got the time of day. It never, ever showed any indications of being anything but a small comet. For a long time, I'm an amateur astronomer myself with relatively good equipment, and I couldn't find it for quite a while. And now it's more visible, but it never was unusual. We have 32 comets in the solar system right now, you can see with a small telescope, and this one had nothing unusual. So the dating, that was I was on before, I don't know, a little while ago on Coast, and mm-hmm. trying to calm the internet fanatic, just the craziness that had been going around, and a lot of it using my name, trying to duplicate, or not really duplicate, but use terms like I would use them, like electrical alignment,
right,
causing earthquakes. And there was just never any basis for this. A lot of people don't understand what gravity is like in outer space. Essentially, we're weightless with respect to all of the other planets. As we move, Earth moves through space, or this is the same, say you put an astronaut out in space, they're without gravity. They're moving along a curved path within the gravitational fields of all the planets and the sun, but each individual item is weightless with respect to everything else. So the only thing you're dealing with are what are known as differential forces. One side of the object is attracted more, the close side is attracted more than the far side. So it provides a minuscule force. Unless you're very close and you're a very big object, those factors, those forces don't even come into play. So what you have is a lot of amateurs, a lot of speculation on the internet, people that have no clue what they're talking about, people that, and why anybody would listen to this and why they got the so high on the Google search list, that's the mystery. Not that Comet Elenin was any threat at all, but how did all of this misinformation and these people with no experience and no ability to analyze it in any normal respect, how would they get so much airtime?
And exposure. So it's not the precursor to end times.
No, no, this is. And the only thing I can think is that this was a well-designed misinformation campaign to distract a lot of people. And anytime this happens, you get a lot of people that the next time, it's the cry wolf syndrome.
That's right.
The next time, people are not going to listen because, oh, that's just another Comet Elenin story.
I mean, one could get very close to us one day, whether it's an asteroid or a comet. It could be very disruptive to us, James.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I talk about that all the time, but you have to understand which ones would be dangerous and which ones wouldn't be. And Comet Elenin didn't even rank. We talk about Comet Halley in 1910, the Earth passed through its tail. Comet Halley is a little teeny comet, and Elenin is technically, as far as I can tell, is smaller than that. And we're not passing through its tail. We're not, it's just kind of passing in front of us. But yeah, no, if you look at a comet like Hale-Bopp, Hale-Bopp was on a direct collision course with Earth. Within about a million miles.
Oh, jeez, that's too close.
When it was first discovered, but it slowed down over a period of maybe 3 years or so. And when it finally came around to where Earth was, Earth had already moved ahead 3 months, so we missed it by a lot. So comets are strange things. The ancients used to call them the lawless ones because they really didn't obey the laws of celestial mechanics. And it's really true. They have kind of a mind of their own. They can change orbits. They can modify their orbits slowly over time. And it appears the bigger comets change more than the little comets. And that's because of the tail drag. The tail is being drawn into the nucleus. And the bigger the tail, the more the orbit can be changed.
What's the tail made up with, Jim?
I'm not sure the composition for Elenin. I don't know if anybody's really spectroscopically looked at it, but typically water is the main component, hydrocarbons, and then you have elements such as sulfur. You have the hydrocarbons, of course. Then you have nitrogen compounds, a lot of ammonias. So basically, it's the building blocks. They have found I forget which comet, was it Comet Build 2 that they went through the tail and picked up material? They found the nucleotide building blocks of DNA they found in comets. But these are, if you understand what they are, they're just simple chemical constructs from basic elements of nitrogen, carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. So it wouldn't be unusual to find them in a chemical mix that is in the tail of comets. So, but basically, basic chemicals, the hydrocarbons can get all the way up to big chains. And it's my contention that that's where hydrocarbons on Earth come from big comets that roll through the solar system. And we pass through the tail of these comets now and then. And you're talking about a month or two within a tail. And it just comes raining, it comes pouring in, and that's where the hydrocarbons, the oil, basically, and the ancients confirm that. They talk about the naphtha coming in from outer space. They talk about that in the ancient texts. But that gives you a good glimpse of what would be in the tail of comets. And then spectroscopically, these are measured. So, we know it's a good mixture of chemical mixing that's going on up there in the comet tail.
All right, James, stay with us. We're going to keep you for some phone calls this half hour as we talk with Professor James McCanney. Okay, we're going to open up the phone lines now this half hour with Professor James McCanney as we talk about Comet Elenine. You know, the Hopis, was this their blue star? So we'll check in with you next hour. Dr. John Brandenburg joins us as we talk about one of his new theories. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. We're with James McCanney. Professor, would you agree with this statement that it's not a matter of if we're going to get hit by something, it's just when?
Exactly. And not only hit, but if big things come from outside the solar system and come near, they can be more devastating than a direct hit from a little object. So my contention is that the past major events, nothing even really hit the Earth, maybe some debris, but the object simply passed by, causing flooding, the damage, the electrical effects, the mountain building, etc. So, exactly, it's not a matter of if, it's simply a matter of when. And the statistics, it's the billiard game of outer space is what we're dealing with.
Let's hope it's not a big when it happens.
Yes. Well, we just don't know. And NASA started a program a number of years ago looking for big objects out there. And they are finding them. I understand they have found over 40, and they stopped talking about it. They have another program looking for big objects in other solar systems, and they say on average there's at least one rogue Jupiter-sized planet in every solar system in the galaxy.
All right, to the phones we go. We'll go to Scottsdale, Arizona, to get things going. First-time caller. Hey, Scott, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, James. I'm not going to be combative in my approach to this, but I want to say this, James, just right off the bat, George, as well. I've noticed that over the last 7 nights, Comet Elenine has been part of the show over the last 4 or 5 nights. So right there, it leads me to believe this isn't a small, wimpy comet. But what I think millions of other people are starting to draw together, guys, are the following events. Hillary Clinton's unprecedented meeting back in March, where she had every ambassador that goes around the world in one room to be told something in person. The Pope is having all of the bishops back in November. Well, that's another unprecedented event. Every country that could afford it has sent up an infrared telescope the last couple of years. Why would you need an infrared telescope to look at a wimpy ball of ice? That's something that looks for heat. I could go on and on. The Near Earth Observatory's project being military classified, seed vaults, Jupiter losing a strike.
Well, Scott, what if it's not Elenine, though, but something else out there? What do you think about that?
How about this? NASA says that 80% of the solar systems observed are binary. They just announced that WISE, the Wide Infrared Scanning, found 11 or something brown dwarfs in our neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. They're all over the place.
Yeah, that's what I was just saying.
Go ahead, James. Let's react to this.
The point is that, yeah, there's a lot of things going on. There's earthquakes. There's volcanoes going off. But Comet Elenine is not the cause of them. There are 32 comets right now in the solar system, some of them bigger and brighter than Elenine. So and predicting and associating things, it's more than just saying, well, during a 6-month or 12-month period, these things happened, therefore it's due to this. It could be caused by also the price of refrigerators going up, but it's not. The issue is, and like George was saying, is there something else out there, something else coming in? Bill Gates just completing a big telescope facility along with a research center down in southern Chile. Why he's got another telescope he supports at the South Pole? Why all the activity at the South Pole? Nobody's building telescopes at the North Pole.
And his friend Paul Allen has been the one who's been funding SETI. So who knows what's going on there?
Yeah, there are things going on, but it's not Comet Elenine. That's exactly what George was saying.
James, do you think governments would hold back information if they knew an asteroid might be coming this way or even a comet?
Oh, absolutely. And the scientists at NASA, for example, anybody that has access to equipment or government funding, they're all under gag orders. They can't run out and jump up and down and say, hey, I saw an asteroid coming. No, they cannot do that, and they all know that they can't. They have to go through release agencies. There are two major NASA release agencies. One is at Goddard. One is at JPL, and their news is homogenized and filtered. So in those agencies have instructions, and they don't want to cause a national or international panic. But people have to understand the dual nature of information we get. A lot of this, like Comet Elenin information, false information, comes from organized disinformation campaigns. These are people with PhDs in disinformation. How to influence the public? How do we want to get the public to think a certain way? And then on the other side, a month, 2 months later, as in the case with Comet Elenin, in come the white hats. I call them the white hats at NASA, and they're totally oblivious to the fact that this dog and pony disinformation campaign is going on. So they state the NASA view. And so the people are so confused by the time this is done that and then you have all of the amateur information that's coming out, for example, on Comet Elenin. What's a poor person to believe when you're just inundated with all this bad information?
Sure, no question about that.
You have to understand the nature of what's going on today, especially regarding science.
All right, let's go to Quebec in Canada, east of the Rockies. Hey, Mark, go ahead.
Hey, thanks very much, Professor James. I have a sort of two-part question I'd like to ask about Venus. I've never heard a good explanation as to why Venus rotates in the opposite direction of the other planets in our solar system. And I guess I'm also wondering, is there any way for us to know if it was possible that it might be hollow?
Okay, we're talking about Venus. Why does it rotate the other way, and do you think it could be hollow?
I don't believe it's hollow because we have satellites. Many, many satellites have gone around Venus and used Venus as a gravitational pull, and so the consistency of an object. Also, you have to understand the pressures inside an object. The crust of a planet is not like a piece of steel or a plate. We talked about tectonic plates, for example. Venus doesn't have any. But these are not solid pieces. If you cut a piece of the Earth's plate, for example, you couldn't pick it up with a big crane. It would all crumble. The Rocky Mountains, if you cut a big piece out of it and think you're going to pull up this big piece of granite, no, it's all going to crumble. And so gravitationally, when these things pull together, there's no room. You have caves and caverns down there, but you don't have major vacuum areas down in the middle of a planet the size of Venus or Earth. The pressures are just too great, and they would crumble and compress until they become a single solid piece. But the interesting thing about Venus rotation, it always shows the same side to Earth, which indicates to me that it was in a gravitational coupling with Earth not very long ago, because that's something that would change and would vary. So within very recent times, Venus had a physical gravitational coupling with Earth, just like our moon. And that so it rotates backwards because it literally is showing the same face to Earth all the time. But Venus, yeah, is not rotating, and that's one of the things that convinces us that, for example, the greenhouse effect is not the cause of the high temperature of Venus, because the side away from the sun never gets around to see the sun. How does the heat get around to the dark side of Venus is one of the obvious questions. There are many, many questions regarding this greenhouse effect heating Venus. There are no surface wind currents on Venus, so how do you get the heat from the sunward side around to the dark side that has exactly the same temperature? So Venus has some interesting questions. The only real good explanation for Venus is that it's a young planet.
A young one indeed. As, of course, Velikovsky says it's a captured comet. It must have been a big one, Jim.
It was, and the ancients talk about this. The Mayans, everybody likes to talk about the Mayans and the Mayan calendar. The Popol Vuh is very specific that Venus was Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, who ruled the night sky, and Earth had two events where Venus came close to Earth. We were talking about events, the Earth-damaging events, and it came by twice, 54 years apart, which is part of the 54-year Mayan cycle. But eventually, the heart of Quetzalcoatl became the planet Venus. And so that's their mythological story of how Venus became a planet from a large comet. And these stories are all over the world. It's not just the Mayans. But that's what my science explains, is how this happens. It didn't come from a little snowball. Venus was a major comet discharging the solar capacitor, and over time it built up as it drew in the tail material and changed its orbit. We saw a modern comet doing this, Hale-Bopp, changed its orbit over a six-year period. It went from a 4,200-year orbit to a 2,500-year orbit in the matter of about 6 years, simply from tail drag.
Interesting.
Anyway, that's a short history, and Venus was no different.
Let's go to Houston, Texas. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hi. I don't think that the alanine has any sort of a blue color to it, does it?
I don't know. Does it? Does it have a blue sheen to it at all, James, because of...
No, it's been a fairly weak comet. There are blue comets. And, in fact, Hale-Bopp looked fairly blue. But the blueness is due to the electrical current passing through the comet. It literally lights it up like a light bulb. And it's one of those controversial topics that comet scientists don't like to talk about in public, because it's not just reflected sunlight. But to answer your question, Comet Elenin did not show significant. Comet Hyakutake, in the 90s, was very blue, for example. It was a very excited comet. That's the first one that they discovered X-rays in front of the comet, for example. But it had a lot of ultraviolet and blue tones to it. That's because literally that very... Some comets are much more active as far as the discharge of the solar capacitor. And when they're blue, that means literally they're lighting up like a light bulb, like a fluorescent light bulb. The gases are lighting up because they're the same. They're gases in a vacuum, just like a fluorescent tube, except they're free in outer space. So the electron beam passing through lights them up. Very simple physics.
And you know, Jim, the group that says October 21st is going to be the end time for all of us, I bet they're going to jump all over this comet as it gets closer.
As the comet Elenin?
Yeah.
You're talking. Well, yeah, that's the one of the predictions. That's about the date when it comes the closest to Earth, I believe. And then November 4th, there's another alignment, I think October 19th. It crosses Earth's orbit. And so, yeah, there's a lot of stories out there, but this comet is not something you would look at for any kind of damage. Or I've looked at it in terms of weather. November 24th, it's due to electrical alignment on the backside of Earth, on the non-sunward side of Earth. And by that time, it's really pretty far away. Comets can have effects if there's other factors like new moons or passing new moons. Those could have effects on our weather, but essentially these are not gravitational effects. That's one of the things you hear a lot on the internet, oh, the gravitational effect or the alignments, and it's really not the gravitational alignments are a non-issue in celestial mechanics. Electrical alignments can have effects, but they have to be, I have a whole set of standards in my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the physics of sun-earth weather. And Comet Elenin doesn't pass any of these tests. So, I mean, we could have a thunderstorm, potentially we could have a hurricane activity on November 24th timeframe, but that's it. That's the maximum extent of what you would see from this comet.
All right, let's go to Kyle, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Kyle, thanks for holding.
Hey, no problem. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Great.
I just have a comment about this whole 2012 thing, and a lot of people are basing it on the Mayan calendar and all the stuff we've gotten from the Mayans, but, you know, when the Spanish conquistadors invaded their, kingdom, I guess, you know, they destroyed a lot of those documents, and I think what we're doing is like taking the first five pages and the last five pages of a book and trying to fill in the story in between.
Well, that could be. Go ahead.
The situation with the Mayan calendar, the Mayan calendar we see today was solidified around 800 A.D. If you can't extrapolate this back thousands of years because the solar system was different. I just did a little conversation about Lake Superior and the Great Lakes. They formed 10,000 years ago. How do you have a glaciated area on the North American side of the planet, this side of the North Pole, and on the Siberian side? It's a tropical temperate climate. It doesn't make any sense. Something major happened about 10,000 years ago, and a pole shift was a very big part of that. So that the Earth doesn't jump up and do this by itself. That means something major came by Earth and caused this. And there's historical records of it. There were, if you look at all the old texts, they're all very specific that the Earth was highly, highly populated before these events, and they went down to, the populations went down to near zero. Not only were things, people killed, but major areas were completely destroyed. So the Earth has gone through some changes recently, and the Mayan calendar, the Mayan history going back to the Olmecs, which we know fairly little about, there's a lot of what you might call dead archaeological area in there that we really don't know about. But the modern Mayans still were adopting and using their calendars and number system, et cetera. A good example, I've spent a lot of time in Mexico and around archaeological sites. And for example, Chichen Itza, one of the major sites, doesn't run northeast, south, or west. It runs 13 degrees off of northeast, south, and west. And when you look at the old North Pole, based on Chichen Itza, the layout of the city, it runs up to a North Pole that's somewhere in southern Ontario, right in the center of the old Laurentian ice cap. So those cities are old, and the Mayans, we know, rebuilt them many times. But to answer your question, it is like... we're taking the first and the last five pages of a book and trying to put it together. And it's sometimes you can do that, but you need to have the right interpretation.
It's going to make for some great radio, James, over the next year and a half. I'll tell you that. Professor James McCanny with us. His website, jmccannyscience.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Thanks, James. Next hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. John Brandenburg, Beyond Einstein's Unified Field, Electromagnetism and Gravity Redefined, a fantastic moment of science. In just a moment on Coast to Coast AM, we shall be right back. Don't touch your dial.